From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Richard Tarnas is a philosopher and a cultural historian, author of the best-selling book, The Passion of the Western Mind. In his recent book, which is called Cosmos and Psyche, he takes the heretical to science view that planetary movements correspond to the course of human events, what he prefers calling archetypal astrology. Skeptics Beyond Guard. Richard Tarnas joins us next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Richard Tarnas is a cultural historian and professor of philosophy and depth psychology. His first book, or his last book really, was called The Passion of the Western Mind. It was a bestseller and we discussed it here on forum. He's a graduate of Harvard and founding director of the Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness Graduate Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies here in San Francisco, and also is a teacher on the faculty of the Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara. His newest book, which is the product of three decades of research, is called Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview, and he joins us this hour. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Good to see you.
I guess let me begin where you began with this book. You begin by quoting Santayana that skepticism is the chastity of the intellect, and most people would say that if you start bringing in astrology, maybe you want to get promiscuous or something along those lines. It occurred to me, we might as well tackle this right away, because here you are, erudite man and a man of great credibility, going against the tide. I mean, saying not predictive astrology, but what you call archetypal astrology, has some real merit to it, has some real cause for credibility. And I was looking back at a statement in the late 1800s, over 100 Nobel laureates said, just out and out, astrology, under any circumstances, dangerous, superstitious, nonsense.
That was done, yes, in the mid-1970s. But it's interesting that...
I saw it coming out, yeah, a review of it, yeah.
But many very good scientists, like including Carl Sagan, actually also wrote a counter to that statement, saying that because he himself had not studied the evidence and did not know the perspective deeply enough to make a judgment, he felt it was not scientifically justifiable to go out and make an a priori claim that it is just illegitimate. So in many ways...
It's funny, because Sagan on the forum program kind of dismissed astrology out of hand. Really,
He did, but he also was open to looking at evidence, and I think he didn't pursue the evidence in that case, but he definitely went up publicly to say we're out of our element if we're just, you know, kind of putting up an inquisition-like... forbidding of this whole area of inquiry.
Well, give us some evidence. I mean, because you do in the book talk about planetary alignment, and most people feel that, admittedly, a lot of the associations with astrology are silly and, you know, newspaper horoscopes and all that sort of thing, but you really make a case here.
Well, you know, I think the newspaper horoscope columns that we... I think associate with astrology, if we haven't done any serious research with it, it's kind of like the relationship of a snake oil salesman to modern medicine is the relationship of a sun sign horoscope column in a newspaper to, you know, authentic astrological research. But let me start by saying I am completely sympathetic to the skeptical posture in relationship to astrology, because that's one that I held as well for many years. I could not imagine that there could be any validity to it, and it was only in a series of stages that I came to change my mind, and it was the evidence. And I don't think anybody who gets a good 20th century education and has assimilated the basic assumptions of modern cosmology would be likely to entertain the possibility that astrology works, because it assumes that the movements of the planets have some intrinsic, meaningful relationship to the patterns of human experience. And the only way that could be true is if the cosmos is not disenchanted. That is, the only way that could be true is if human intelligence is not the only intelligence in town. It suggests that, I mean, and this is what the evidence has gradually kind of influenced me to accept the possibility that, as Gregory Bateson would say, mind is not just in the human being. Mind is in nature, and mind is in the cosmos, and we seem to be participating in larger fields of meaning.
Suggesting a creative intelligence. In
exactly. That, and it also suggests that somehow the ancient and traditional indigenous cultures may have had insights into the nature of the universe that the modern mind, for all its brilliance, may have lost access to. You know, for example, when an indigenous person from centuries ago or even today walks out into the forest, they experience presences in the forest, and when they see two eagles flying across the horizon and a baby's born at the same time, they believe or experience this as being significant, it's meaningful. And the reason that they see these things as meaningful, the reason they experience spirits in the forest or meaning in the movements of the wind or the alignments of the planets or the cycles of the sun and moon, is that they experience nature as ensouled, that in a sense the human psyche is seen as continuous with a world psyche, an anima mundi, as the ancient Platonists would have called it. And so rather than seeing, as the modern would, that it's just a random movement of nature that happened to coincide with, say, the birth of the child, they would see nature and the cosmos as pregnant with meanings and purposes that we as human beings can be sensitive to and thereby participate more intelligently in the unfolding of life.
Would require, though, either some intuitive leap or a leap of faith, something along those lines, because certainly, I mean, I was struck by when you talk about these hard alignments of outer planets of Pluto, Neptune, and Saturn and Jupiter matching with sequences and patterns of simultaneous historical events. I thought, wow, you know, this is fascinating. But it all could be very coincidental, as you suggest, or just random.
It could be coincidental, but as the philosopher of science, Percy Bridgman, once put it, he said, coincidences are what are left over after you've applied a bad theory. And because basically coincidences are patterns that we see, and they may be random, but if there are a sufficient number of coincidences, then that alerts the scientific mind or the simply the intellectually acute mind to seek an underlying cause for those patterns or an underlying framework that makes those patterns intelligible. So,
which could be an imposition of a framework, in many cases is, in fact.
That's right. We are all, as human beings, extremely prone to projection. And so the only way to overcome projection is to do a sufficient amount of research with an adequate degree of sensitivity to what one is studying rather than to one's own intrinsic need to project one's own intrinsic need to have there be meaningful patterns that would somehow make us more comfortable in life. I mean, the human being wants to see patterns, partly to survive better, but partly to feel that they are more at home in the universe. So it takes a constant, judicious balance of critical intelligence or rigor and an openness to the possibility that there, in fact, may be a pattern here that is independent of my projection.
Well, let's talk about one of the patterns, for example, you find back in the 6th century BCE, for example, the alignment, very unusual alignment,
yes,
in the planets.
That happens to be the only time in the history of civilization that there was a triple conjunction of the outer three planets, Pluto, Neptune, and Uranus. And those, before I reached that part of the book where I set out that whole sequence of synchronicities or patterns, coincidental patterns, I first pointed out that two of those planets tended to, whenever Pluto and Uranus came into conjunction or opposition, it regularly coincided with major periods of social, political rebellion, revolutionary impulses, and so forth. I mean, the only conjunction of those two planets in the 20th century was during the 1960s, approximately 1960 to 1972. And the meanings of those planets that astrologers have gradually come to with a unanimous consensus now after the last...
Western and non-Western astrologers both?
Well, only the Western astrologers were dealing with the outer three planets. Indian Vedic astrologers worked only out through Saturn. Those were the planets visible to the naked eye. And so they were not incorporated into the Vedic tradition. But Western astrologers did work with the planets discovered by the telescope. So basically, first I noted that there was these periods such as the 1960s, and then, for example, the same two planets were in alignment during the 1787 to 1798 period of the French Revolution. Again, that same quality of a massive impulse to make the world new and to violently overthrow the old order and to bring new freedoms and kind of creative innovation. It's the same thing that was happening in the 60s, again, the French Revolution, again, 1640s, 50s, the British, the English Revolution. It was so consistent. And by contrast, the other set of conjunctions, Uranus and Neptune, coincided consistently with periods of religious awakening and spiritual, the birth of new religions, and so forth. And that happened to coincide with the beginning of Christianity, the beginning of Islam, the Great Awakening in the American colonies in the 1730s and 40s. And we actually are just now completing these last 15 to 20 years have had the most recent conjunction of those two planets, where we again have had this tremendous intensification of the religious impulse, esoteric and spiritual traditions, awakening and so forth. Well, it was after seeing these sequences of consistent correlations between these kind of these zeitgeists that would kind of take over in not only one culture but many cultures
at the time,
the spirit of the time, coinciding so consistently with these planetary alignments that I then this is after actually doing the research for quite a few years because we didn't have computers in the 1970s, personal computers that could just simply open up in 5 seconds and show us where the planets were. Gradually, I extended the research back, and there's many of us that are doing this research until the I checked to see, well, what was going on in the 6th century B.C., because that period, or 6th century B.C.E., that period is completely unique in history because it's a period when basically across all the high civilizations of the world, there was this enormous awakening of new religions, the birth of new religions. This is a period of the Buddha, of the birth of Taoism, of Confucianism in India and China. And this is the period when in Judaism, when the Bible begins to be redacted, and the great prophets Ezekiel and Second Isaiah are writing and basically transforming the whole Hebrew understanding of the divine. And it's when Greek philosophy begins with Thales and Pythagoras, and it's when Sappho is writing her extraordinary poetry and so forth. I mean, basically, right across the world, you have this completely unique period of a kind of revolutionary transformation of human consciousness that in certain ways we're still playing out. And it was to see that coinciding with the only triple conjunction of the outer three planets that I had consistently seen when any two of them had come into conjunction. They had coincided with either, you know, major social political transformations involving, and that's when more Pluto was involved, and when Neptune was involved, it seemed to coincide very consistently with spiritual, religious kind of consciousness transformations.
Of course, Pluto may not even be a planet, right?
Well,
is that whole?
Exactly.
But even if we concede all of this, and you know, you've done a lot of mathematical and analytical interpretation. I realize a lot of this is very Jungian. I mean, with the synchronicity that you mentioned, and
yeah, the archetypal fields.
Archetypal fields and so forth. And Jung was one who was certainly open to astrology. Even assuming all this, you know, to go forward with the notion that this means that we're moving to a belief in a creative intelligence and an interconnectedness of the universe and maybe a transformative time that's beneficent rather than malignant and all of those kinds of things seems to me even a bigger leap. Because that's where you're moving, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I think it's too, you know, I often have the feeling when talking about just a few correlations such as this that it's, on the one hand, in the book and in my research and the research of, you know, I had 30 scholars who were advanced readers of this book who were reading it the chapters as I was completing it year by year, and we've been doing this work, and I've often had the feeling in a single lecture or an interview where one can only toss out a few, you know, potentially intriguing correlations that it's like in the research itself, I have this great sword in a sense of powerful evidence, but one can only bring up a safety pin worth of evidence
The book is a tome. People are going to have to read the book if they're, that's true about a lot of the books we do, of course. You know,
sure.
We can only whet people's appetites
exactly.
And go so far within the course of an hour, but there are a lot of important things that you're saying here. I mean, you're talking about really a change in consciousness, and you're talking about it from the perspective of someone who's really trying to gauge things by how the stars, in this case the planets, affect our lives in ways that are really harmonious and that suggest much deeper truths. You're getting into levels, in other words, that I think many people are hungry for in this age that we live in, but also very skeptical about.
Yes, and I think as I started the book out with that quote from Santayana that skepticism is the chastity of the intellect, I think it's very important to be cautious and to not give in to every new idea that comes across the horizon. On the other hand, we also know that it's only when we enter into an idea. Basically, the purpose of skepticism, like the purpose of chastity, is to be fully prepared for the true beloved, the one the whose aim is true, and without that capacity to open to a perspective or evidence that actually does have truth, we wall ourselves off in a kind of armored state of skeptical isolation that never is able to enter deeply into a perspective that may in fact have great healing potential or may open us up to new realities and new worlds.
Well, that's what I see. I mean, not that you're a polemicist, but that's what I see is the intentionality behind a lot of your book. That is to take us away from this deconstructive view we have of the universe and to reconstruct the universe in a creative way and in a connected way and a way that's not as fragmentary or perhaps is more intuitive and goes to the heart of that. It's just that, you know, most of us are pretty resistant to that. I mean, we're trained to be resistant to that.
Yeah.
We're conditioned to be resistant.
As I was. Maybe I should say precisely what started opening me up to it. I first encountered it actually as an undergraduate at Harvard in the late 60s. And there was a professor there at the Harvard Divinity School, a Swiss professor who had been trained by Jung. And we had regular discussions, and he one day started talking to me about astrology and even saying some things about my birth chart. So I must have given him my birth data, but I'd forgotten it when he started talking about it. And I quickly moved the discussion right back to our usual channels of discourse because
out of discomfort.
Because I just thought this was he had temporarily taken leave of his good senses, and so there were several years after that I did not have any encounter with astrology, and it wasn't until I had come to do research in my graduate years, I came to Esalen Institute to study with Joseph Campbell and Gregory Bateson and Houston Smith, but particularly with Stan Grof. Stanislav Grof is the founder of transpersonal psychology and was the scholar in residence for many years at Esalen. And I came to study there with him. We eventually became very good friends, and we actually now have been teaching courses now, graduate courses over 15 years now, on this research, because what we discovered, totally to our astonishment, we were basically researching, we were trying to understand why different people have such different responses to the exact same experiences. Stan Grof happened to be the world's expert in LSD psychotherapy, coming from Prague for many years, and then the National Institute of Mental Health in Baltimore. And we were interested in why the same person at different times could have such radically different experience with the same substance, two different people have, one person could have a tremendous spiritual awakening, a psychologically liberating experience, and another person could have quite a nightmarish descent into a dark night. All the conventional tests, MMPI, TAT, Rorschach, the conventional psychology tests, had been tried by researchers to try to predict what the responses people would have to this experience or to this particular drug, and none of them had any predictive value. Well, as you probably remember, in the 60s and 70s, Esalen was an extraordinary, and it still is in many ways, center where many different perspectives, East and West, ancient and modern, esoteric and so forth, were explored with great seriousness. And one of them happened to be astrology. And we decided, partly picking up on suggestions from Jung, because Jung had written quite a bit about astrology, and we later found out that he used astrological charts and what are called transits for understanding, work with all of his clients in his later years, the later 1940s, early 50s. So following those suggestions, we started doing research. We learned how to calculate birth charts, and then we learned how to calculate transits, which is where...
Hold that thought, Richard, because sure. We're coming up on a break here, and I want to give out the phone number. We're talking with Richard Tarnas, author of a new book called Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview, and you are welcome to join us with your thoughts or any questions you may have or reactions to what you've heard here. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls. 866-733-6786, or join us by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Talking to Richard Tarnas, his new book is called Cosmos and Psyche, and I didn't realize you sort of did a chart on me.
Well, a friend of mine a friend of yours happened to went here last Friday that I was going to be on the show on the radio, and so she emailed me to say, what a pleasure it would be to be on the air with you, which of course I knew from our time 15 years ago with doing Passion of the Western Mind.
When Tim Ferriss called me to say he was listening to us, and it was words to the effect of as good as it gets, he was in his car and the sun was shining and the windows were open, and he said, this is really what I enjoy most about life, listening to this kind of discourse. I know there are people who are listening to this now and thinking, astrology? You've got to be kidding me. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, as a result of our mutual friend sending me this email, she mentioned enough about, she happened to know your birth data, that I thought, well, it'd be interesting to just see you know, see your chart. I've, you know, of course, listened to you frequently as I drive to school to teach classes and so forth. It happens to coincide with when I'm driving into the city. And so I feel like I have a pretty decent sense of your personality in many ways. And the to see one of the outstanding configurations in your birth chart that I could see right away is that you have this Mercury-Jupiter conjunction. Well, this is Mercury seems to relate to the part of the whole archetypal principle of mind and the impulse to communicate and the capacity for articulation. While Jupiter seems to be associated, the planet Jupiter seems to be associated with an archetypal principle of expansiveness and elevation. When you put those two together in conjunction, you regularly see this with people who have more than the usual kind of breadth of mental vision, a kind of generosity of intelligence, and also an ease of articulation. In addition, you happen to have it in a larger configuration in which Uranus is involved, which I thought, oh, this is just perfect, because you see this very often where there's an almost Promethean lightning-like speed of mind. And when I think of your preternatural ability, if you don't mind my saying so, of being able to put on eight different sustained interviews, going so in such an informed way each week to through so many different fields, so many different books and political debates and controversies and so forth, and to handle it with such ease and aplomb. You're like a kind of Joe Montana of the that kind of speed and agility Joe Montana of the interview radio world.
This is very kind and flattering. Though I must say, a couple of things quickly come to mind. Of course, there are many people who would rather than see me as Joe Montana, would rather see me on the bench, but or maybe not even on the team. But there's also the sense of, this is because of my birthday, I presume. I mean, there are people who were born on the same day that I was born.
That's
on,
right.
Who are very different than I am.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's what astrologers often say. Well, it depends on the time and the conjunction.
No, more than that. There's two major, I think, clarifications that anybody needs to understand before one goes too deeply into this perspective. One of them is that I don't think the evidence supports the idea that the planets in any way cause things to happen. It's the kinds of correlations we're talking about are not suggestive of a kind of physical causality that is like, say, gravity or electromagnetic radiation or something like that. Rather, it seems that there is a coincidence between, that is a correlation or a correspondence between the planetary movements on the one hand and the and these archetypal patterns, either in an individual's life and personality and character, or also on the collective level. And it's not a causal relationship. In the same way that, you know, we look at the clock right now, the hands on the clock say it's 25 minutes to 11. The hands on the clock are not causing it to be 25 minutes to 11. Rather, they are indicate it, and that seems to be what the situation is with the planets. They are indicative of a larger field of meaning, rather than causing particular, you know, traits or forms of experience. The second big clarification is that these archetypal principles are multivalent. That is, they have many potential ways of expressing themselves and still being true to their underlying principle. So, for example, I give the example of Lincoln and Darwin. Lincoln and Darwin were born on the exact same day, February 12, 1809, and one's born in the wilderness of the American colonies in complete the American wilderness in the early days of the United States, but with no resources in utter poverty. And on the other hand, Darwin is born in basically to the imperial power of England, to an elite class. And yet the two individuals' lives and their personality structures and their capacities, mental, positive and negative, I mean, are problematic. Their tendencies towards melancholic depression and their loss of their mothers, both when they were, 8, 9 years old.
But I remember matching, for example, this is a strange thing I did a number of years ago, people who were born on the same day because I thought they have the same kind of alignment. And
same day and same year?
Yeah. And you came up with some very strange duos, to be sure. Let me give you a sample. You could have almost predicted some of the skepticism from some of our listeners. Let me just give you a sample of it. Here's one who says, is this research published and peer-reviewed? It's a little strange to have a pseudoscience discussion on KQED. Here's Mark, who says, apophenia is the spontaneous perception of connections and meaningfulness of unrelated phenomena. In statistics, apophenia is called a type 1 error, seeing patterns where none in fact exist. It is highly probable that the apparent significance of many unusual experiences and phenomena are due to apophenia. Example, ghosts and hauntings, EVP, numerology, the Bible code, anomalous cognition, and he goes on and on. Here's one from Pat who says, oh my God, religion continues masquerading as New Age touchy-feely science. Please ask your guest if he is a believer in the currently fashionable religious doctrine of intelligent design and or is connected with the Seattle-based Discovery Institute. I'm disappointed that KQED would provide airtime to this topic, particularly asking such credulous questions sympathetic to the religious proselytizer. Astrological observations are as important in the Bible as a harbinger to Jesus' birth, although Christians gloss over that part of the story. And here's Matt, who says, how can you take things like this seriously? If you take this new philosophy to its illogical conclusion, you end up with a casual universe where there is no free choice. I can't believe that you waste airtime on this. There are ways that nature coupled to human behavior. Look at seasons, planting seasons, winter disorders from not enough sun in the northern extreme latitudes. Barometric pressures can affect birth times. But going to external forces, making two eagles fly at the birth of specific babies, means the eagles have no choice, and that the exact moment of birth is coordinated with the flight of the birds? Who or what does this? You end up at the same philosophical dead end that if these hypotheses are in fact correct, we're all in a dance where the steps are proscribed, but we're just too dumb to know it, and we persist in the folly that our choices are our own. There goes free choice. There goes personal responsibility.
Okay, well, there's a whole lecture worth of issues to address
some.
There.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with the first about pseudoscience. I think science is properly not an established worldview. Rather, it's a method of knowing. It's an approach to discovering knowledge. And so good science, I think, is an approach to knowledge that questions assumptions and tests hypotheses and is open to evidence, even when that evidence might challenge the existing paradigm. So I agree that this research is perhaps heretical to mainstream science, it is not intrinsically unscientific because it is, in fact, what I've attempted to do with this book is to provide a kind of archetypal telescope to a larger vision of the universe. And I ask readers who are both open-minded and willing to question their assumptions, but also rigorous, I invite them to basically look through the telescope and see what they see. And we know Galileo was not able to get some of the professors and priests to look through his telescope because they knew what they would find and that it would not support the Copernican universe.
But it's almost as if you're going against a kind of view of the universe here. I mean, just the response you got is indicative to me. And by the way, this is why I wanted to get this on, because I thought it would be good discourse.
Sure.
And good intelligent argument. And I mean, could like I people challenging Darwin, for example. It's like people sure. saying evolution doesn't exist. In many people's minds, you realize that's exactly what it's like.
Yeah. Well, those who have read the book know that I'm extremely, you know, sympathetic to the and spend a lot of time with Darwin and Copernicus and Galileo and so forth. I see the whole scientific enterprise in an extremely positive way. And no, I'm to answer the question of one of your the people who called in. No, I'm not associated with the Discovery Institute and
or intelligence.
Yeah, intelligent design.
That's a
Christian fundamentalist attempt to basically counter evolutionary theory, and that's not what my work is about at all.
Let's go to our callers, and Maria is first up. Morning, and thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Maria, are you there? Going once for Maria. Okay, then we'll go to another caller. And that caller, I guess, would be you, Jeremy. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me preface my comments first by saying that I worked for 6 years on the Human Genome Project as a sequence assembly manager and published my work in peer-reviewed journals. And so, therefore, I'm quite intimate in the process by which the scientific community constructs the objects with which it then refers causality to its systems. And so I was calling this morning and, of course, getting the perpetual busy signal, started to the cosmos and said, well, I'll have a sign when to call and it won't be busy. And a hawk cried above and I pressed redial and, of course, I got through. So that is the preface. I wanted to see if you guys could speak a little bit, or if Rick could speak to the recent discussion of whether or not Pluto is a planet. And I think it was on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We actually had scientists saying, well, you know, we've been talking about it as a planet for so long that we shouldn't go back and actually rewrite it, because actually it is a planet. And there was sort of a nuanced understanding that the human mind and the current practice of science participates in constructing the objects that therefore confer causality upon scientific models. So I guess what I'm getting at is a lot of the skepticism that comes from the scientific community is not a scientific concern, but rather an illogical claim to materialism, to saying all things being equal, the material cause will be primary, and there's this knee-jerk, almost equivalent to Christian fundamentalist or intelligent design movement, to do not give me any cause that's not material. So I'll take my comments off the air, but I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Thank you for the call.
Yes, I think he's getting an important point, which is that it's a pretty much fundamental assumption that in the mainstream scientific community right now that the only legitimate causation is material causation. And that is an assumption that is open to question, and I think there is a vast amount of evidence that suggests that it may not be a valid assumption.
Maria, I think we have you now, do we not?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Oh, I first have a comment, and then I have a question to ask. The first comment is that I've been into astrology for many, many, many years, more years than I care to mention. And one of the things I learned about astrology is you never do a person's chart unless that person gives you the permission to do it. So I think it's unethical to have taken Michael's astrology, or his friend has given it to him without Michael's consent, and then to put it on the air. So that's number one.
Michael doesn't care, by the way.
Well, it's still unethical, Michael, whether you care or not.
Could I just mention that our mutual friend that shared that the birth data with me said that she had talked to Michael that this was okay, and that Michael actually asked me in the break if we could discuss this, so I would never have brought it up on the air had he not invited me.
Well, then you should have said that Michael gave you consent to do it, and otherwise I wouldn't be calling. The second question is, the question that I have is, how much of your research is based on the research that was done by the Galikun brothers in France in astrology and causation and taking the planets and mapping out conceptually the different occurrences that happened, say, in the 6th century? And these are two.
That was Sure, I can respond to that. You're referring to the Gauquelins, who actually were a husband and wife, Michel and Francois Gauquelin. And the Gauquelins did a tremendous amount of statistical research in the beginning of the 1950s. It's the main body of statistical research that that affirms that basically has been affirmative of astrological principles. And I don't actually use it because, I mean, I refer to it in the book, but it's of minimal importance in terms of the larger body of research, because statistics are not capable of handling the multivalent character of the archetypes. An example I gave in the book is we have Charlie Chaplin and Adolf Hitler are born very close to each other and just 4 days apart. They have very similar charts. And while they have a number of quite interesting similarities in their biographies, including certain dictatorial tendencies. And
Chaplin played Hitler.
And Chaplin brilliantly played Hitler, and they both had artistic tendencies. They both put on vast persuasive illusions that influenced millions, and yet what a radically different moral vector that the that these two individuals played out in their lives. And that's an example of how I don't believe astrology can be predictive, but it's not concretely predictive. Rather, it's archetypally predictive. It seems to give us a sense for larger tendencies that can be inflected in either positive or destructive ways.
Even when you say that, and let me thank Maria for her call. We get emails like Jim's, for example. I just like to voice my opinion. This is total nonsense. People need to take conscious control of their destinies based on the here and now, not on some outer space jive. Of course, you're not saying that people shouldn't take control of their destinies. This is a distinction between predictive astrology and what you call archetypal astrology.
Yeah, we should address the freedom issue in a moment.
But here are some more emails. Could have predicted you'd get hit like this. This is from a listener who says, "It is one of those spurts of nonsense. How can you compare this with Pythagorean theorem or the laws of gravity or the laws of evolution? These stand the proof of time with beauty and grace, but psyche and planets, conjunction or opposition, are just an occult science that divert people from real science. I hope this is not one of those signs of decadence." And here's Vincent who says, "I'm reminded of a psychological experiment in which the subjects were placed in front of a computer and asked to predict whether the computer would produce an A or a B. It may have been a 1 or a 2, but regardless, one of two possible outcomes. The computer was programmed with a random generator that if the subject simply chose A or B the entire time, would have resulted in an aggregate prediction rate of 50%. Because the subjects are human and somehow need to see patterns, they tried to predict what the next integer would be based on. What was in fact a random pattern. As a result, the aggregate prediction rate was less than 50%. The point is, we see patterns in events regardless of whether they are present or not."
Well, let me first respond to the first one you just read there. It's interesting that she says she brings up the Pythagorean theorem, because Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans were deeply interested in the connection between the planetary movements and human affairs. They had an astrological understanding, and the I think this is one of the instances where a kind of historical myopia influences people to make judgments, where they, you know, they on the one hand elevate certain, you know, great figures like Pythagoras and Copernicus and Kepler and Newton and so forth. All of those were involved in astrology, every one of them. Galileo calculated birth charts not only for his patrons, but also for himself and his family, and there's been very good research done in just the last 10 years showing that it was quite clear that these were not just done to satisfy patrons, but that he was using it for his own insight.
Because that would, in some people, not necessarily attest evidence of the validity or the efficacy of astrology, just that maybe people who were scientific also had tendency to do things that were unscientific.
That's true. But on the other hand, to somehow have this elevation of this whole lineage of great thinkers and then say, and astrology is this superstitious nonsense is a kind of contradiction that I think they can only sustain that by not knowing the history. I'd like to address the very important issue of freedom, because that's come up in a number of the emails. I believe the modern mind, and to a certain extent the Christian mind as well, opposed astrology. The Christian mind was a more ambiguous relationship through Augustine and Aquinas. They both had some positive things to say about it, but also had their problems, and it had to do with human freedom. But I think the modern mind in particular moved towards a rejection of astrology for a number of reasons, but one of them was specifically because of this astrological determinism, this tendency for astrologers to make fateful, concrete predictions, and the emerging sense of the modern self was towards being an autonomous being who could define their lives with great freedom. And I would like to point out that the astrological research that is now, I think, most being pursued, and that the evidence that we now have actually suggests that the more we have an understanding of these correlations, the more liberating it is for us as human beings, because it permits us to participate more intelligently, more consciously, in the unfolding of these archetypal forces. If we don't know what archetypal complexes are active at what time in our lives and most inform our particular personality, there's a tendency to be more puppets of them. We're more unconscious of them. This is precisely why Jung used it as much as he did. In many ways, archetypal astrology is a kind of further step in the depth psychology project that Freud and Jung began, which is to make the unconscious conscious.
And to be more aware, presumably, of one's unconscious drives.
Exactly.
We're talking to Richard Tarnas. His book is Cosmos and Psyche, and we go to more of your calls. Grey Wolf, morning.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to thank you for airing this topic, this open mind topic, and I'd also like to thank your guest for comparing the Christian mind with the modern mind, because they're not both modern, are they? Though the Christian mind comes into the modern way, but it goes back thousands of years ago. Now, before I do begin, I'd like to say that I've learned and believe a very special thing about this gravity, which all the planets and all the stars do have an effect, and much, much more than that, something that I learned from Paramahansa Yogananda's writings and studying him, and that is learning about, well, he refers to it as the divine gravitational force, but I won't even go into that now. It's just to say that the thing, and I am an Aquarian, and others have done charts on me without asking, and apparently it's really a cool time to have been born, the day I was born on. But just back to the point, I used to be a Christian minister. I began my Christianity after I learned of what the Catholic Church had been doing in the past, and I left the Catholic Church. Since then, I've learned that you need to forgive the Catholic Church for things that they did thousands of years ago.
Right? Well, forgive me. I mean, you're not a minister anymore, but you're going to have to forgive me here. There's a point in this, I know. I mean, your biography is fascinating, but obviously we've got a lot of calls. And do you have a question or do you have a point?
This is the comment. I believe now this type of thinking is a way of an open mind, you know, what's being discussed right now. And I think it all comes together, and I believe the change is necessary right now in the mainstream spirituality, and that is that we need to focus on the love and the humanity and look for the leaders, and look for not those who are powerful and doing the punishment and the hating and the killing, which is in so many of the religions. I believe we shouldn't destroy it, but we should remove all of the reasons for wars,
Right, let me go to Richard Tarnas on this, because I think we get the sense of the homily that caller is bringing forward here, and it's a kind of, many people's minds, I suspect, sounds a little like kumbaya. I mean, let get right to this notion of, you know, for example, the publicity that comes with your book says this is a new way of combining religion and science. Many people get very ill at ease when they hear religion, combining soul with intelligence or intellect, and they get very nervous when they hear the word soul. Ancient wisdom and modern reason. They like the modernity, but they don't necessarily like the ancient. In other words, you are, you know, going into kind of, as I said earlier, heretical territory.
Yeah. Well, I think all of us have it, whether we call it religion or call it spirituality. I think the spiritual dimension of life is important to all of us, whether we admit it or not. And all of us have grown up with the extraordinary contradiction of living in a universe in which, while we experience ourselves as being purposeful, personal, conscious selves or subjects, we are in a world, a universe that has been defined by our mainstream science as being utterly indifferent to our spiritual aspirations and completely random, and that our consciousness is a mere kind of oddity, an isolated epiphenomenon that accidentally was produced by the universe.
Well, if people want another way, they can find it certainly in your book. Again, the book is Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview. I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but Richard, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Tarnas. Hey, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being here. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.